I guess it's the main course, Patrick. I didn't know you'd get so upset about it.
No, I'm happy.
Whoa, that was very loud.
Yeah, I know. Our sound levels are up a little high. Well, this is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Patrick Martins.
And today we are proud to be sponsored by...
Fairway Market.
And we ain't crying about that, let me tell you. We are very happy that Fairway has signaled their approval. Would you stop that crying, baby?
Why isn't it
stopping?
You're going
to have to kill that baby. Kill the baby, Jack.
I think he's dying on his own.
This is Sound Effects Gone Mad in the studio of Heritage Radio Network here at Roberta's Pizza in beautiful downtown Bushwick, Brooklyn.
So we are sponsored by Fairway Market. They've become new big sponsors of ours, which is kind of cool because, as you know, this whole world of like big supermarket chains and whatnot, they have remained like a New York City institution. Although big for New York, they still maintain quality. And Steve Jenkins is obviously a friend of the network. So.
Yes, we've had Steve on a few times and we hope to have him on a few times more.
So what have you been up to, Katie? Tell me, what was your week like?
I had a really busy week this week. It seems like every week just kind of telescopes into nothing. But the highlight of my week was actually last night when I worked a catering job, which I haven't done in 13 years.
What role did you have at the catering job?
I was working the pizza station.
Really? Yeah. So you were cooking pizza in an oven?
I had to warm pizza up in an oven. It was really challenging.
Your role here at Roberta's inspirational to you?
Well, I'll tell you, it was inspirational in the sense that I recognized how incredibly good the pizza at Roberta's is as compared to other, quote, artisanal pizzas. This was okay pizza, but it was not great.
The food here is really, really good. And I'm not just saying that. I mean, I eat out, you know, for a bunch of years. I know.
You eat out all the time. I never eat out because I'm a good cook. And I like Regina Schrambling said last week, I need to go someplace that's going to make it better than I can. Otherwise, it ain't worth my money.
Absolutely. And there's really, you know, if you think about it, so few great restaurants. And Roberta's truly one. And it's inexpensive also.
It's inexpensive. The quality is super high.
So what do you like about this pizza versus other pizzas? What makes a good pizza?
The crust is key. And one of the things that made this crust fall down on the job was it was inadequately salted. If you don't have enough salt in the crust...
It's like a Tuscan bread.
It's really bland, and it wrecks the rest of the pizza. Also, the crust got really tough on the reheating proposition. It was probably great when it first came out of the oven, but then it sort of dried out. And since I had to heat it up in a little convection oven, it was... I thought, kind of unfortunate. The sauce was very good. They had little shreds of fresh basil, which was also nice. But overall, not a patch on Roberta's. And it didn't have the lovely wood-fired taste that Roberta's has. Mm-hmm. And that really does add something to it.
Yeah, the oven's important.
The oven is very important. The thing that's that was so cool about this party was that it was for a Broadway composer named Michael Shame, who is responsible for the music of the musical Hairspray, among many other award-winning shows. But
some of the songs from Hairspray?
Oh, please don't ask me that. I've never seen it. I've only seen the movie.
Okay.
But what was cool was it was like a who's who of Broadway greats was at this party because they all know Michael and his boyfriend Scott. So they all turned out. We saw Patti LuPone, Christine Ebersole, Martin Short, Matthew Broderick, Harvey Fierstein.
Martin Short is hilarious.
He was hilarious.
Who is his character where he plays that big guy? He plays a kind of obese movie critic.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't remember the movie.
Jiminy Glick.
Oh, right. Jiminy Glick. Yeah.
He's actually inspired a story, a show on Heritage Radio Mike Edison and I want to try to put together where a very obese person does all theater reviews, but from a full bathtub. In the bathtub. You know, and they're just kind of relaxing in there and on Heritage.
Absolutely.
So wow, all these people perform while you were
eating
the pizza?
They all performed, and they were all singing, you know, tributes to Michael, and then there were some very moving sort of, you know, personal tributes that were just spoken. It was a lovely event.
And Sarah Obrightis was there, you said?
And Sarah Obrightis was there. We were both working a station.
What station did she work?
She was working the sort of major food station, like getting all the food out on the tables. And I was sequestered far away across the room in the pizza station all by myself.
And who ate the most pizza? Was it Martin Short, Matthew Broderick?
I think Michael Moore was there. I couldn't tell. Somebody who looked sort of like him, except that they had long hair. I mean, quite honestly, this person was really hideous. But that was the person who ate the most pizza.
Wow.
And they came back again and again and again.
Did they?
Yeah.
But it wasn't Michael Moore. He's not really, when I think Broadway, I don't think Michael Moore I know, so much.
But, you know, there were industry people, a lot of theater industry, a lot of, there were movie people, TV people, I mean.
Well, although talking to Michael Moore, you know, what we're going to cover in the second half of the main course part Q, is Slaughterhouse Live, and talking about all these like Slaughterhouse issues. It kind of seems like an issue that Michael Moore
would tackle. Well, I think that's going to be a lot of fun, actually, that segment, because as you know, Patrick, I read meetingplace.com, and I actually encourage all listeners, whether in the industry or not, to read meetingplace.com, not only for the news about our food chain, but also but also to check in with the responses, because you're allowed to blog after every article, and the responses from readers are really so off the wall that it's no wonder that we're having trouble pushing the needle across to better farming practices. I mean, these people are dinosaurs. They're scary.
No, it's really true.
And it's all the fault. Either it's the fault of the consumer, or it's the fault of President Obama, or it's the fault of, you know, tree-hugging, PETA-loving, you know, commie brats. I mean, honest to God, it's really, it's an eye-opener to see what these people say about everybody who doesn't agree with the status quo of the meat industry. It's really quite something. That's what they do. They do that.
Well, the thing is, it's like, that's how we all eat. Like, if we were to try to change the Cisco, Costco, all that version kind of thing, everyone would starve to death, wouldn't they? I mean, can these farms that we all believe in really, like, you know, someone does a butchering class for 9 people. I mean, is that going to turn the tide?
And it costs $10,000.
Yeah, well, Fleischmann, I want to bring that up. Fleischer's is charging $10,000.
Yeah. And how many consumers are actually going to do... Well,
that just seems like a lot.
Slaughtering their... It's crazy.
It kind of seems like they're ripping people off. $10,000.
Well, I'd like to get somebody from Fleischer's into the studio, actually, sometime. I would, or do a phoner with them, because I would love to get some of them. I'm dying to do
Fleischer's
something
has,
about butchers and the recovering the lost art of butchering. And
for only $7,500, one of them will come into the city and do a radio interview. So that's cool. And then, but if you get them to do a radio interview and you do their thing, rather than $17,500, they'll just do it all for $16,000. $10,000 is bordering on egregious. And they claim that it's to cover the meat cost and their time.
I think you
then
know what those costs are.
They are charging way too much for their time.
Yeah, Patrick. I mean, you know what meat costs. And I know what meat costs, as a matter of fact. I mean,
How much commodity meat do you eat?
I do eat probably a fair amount of commodity beef.
Do you eat boar's head sandwiches, like turkey sandwiches?
I know I don't eat any cold cuts of any kind. Bacon is the only one that I purchase. That is often a commodity product.
So who's our guest today from the Blue Ocean Institute?
Well, the first part of the main course today, we will be interviewing by telephone a wonderful guy named Alan Duckworth, a research scientist from the
Very
Blue
good
Ocean.
Name.
Yeah, I know, right? From the Blue Ocean Institute. Blue Ocean is a conservation and environmental organization that tries to get more people. Create better awareness in people of what's happening in the sea. So what Alan's going to be talking about with us today is pollution, is traceability in fish, in figuring out where our fish is coming from, how best to raise it, what are the big issues in the fishing industry in terms of conservation, education of the consumer, and so on. Anyway, he'll tell us all about it. He's a very smart laddie, and he's got a beautiful New Zealand accent.
And
too.
What it says, it's the only organization that uses science, art, and literature to inspire a closer bond with nature.
I thought that
nature.
Was so cool. I love
and
that.
And he swims with saltwater crocodiles.
Yes, he did. He did mention that. We'll have to ask him about that.
That's pretty
gonna
wild.
Be fun. Yeah.
So I'm just back from San Francisco.
Tell me about your trip. What was the purpose?
Basically to try to raise capital for Heritage Foods. We kind of need to
Any
take
success?
It up a notch. Not really. We were presenting, at a very great conference, but like the other people there were, all good. They weren't on the completely bad side, but they were, things like, straws that have certain things in them or good things, but like, or other companies, some place that claims to cure the common cold and, you know, things that, like, in the end, you would just, my advice would be just eat fruits and vegetables and eat everything in moderation, you know, or if you were going to eat potato chips and stuff, then this would be a better alternative, you know. It's the type of place, like, Annie's was represented there, you know, popcorn, you know, so it's still okay, you know, mac and cheese, if you're going to do that, you should eat, you know, a better version of it, so... yeah, it was kind of cool, but I ate at Chez Panisse, which I thought was delicious. Well, the cafe upstairs. Which
What'd
is
you
nice.
Eat? What I was mean, your
you
dish?
Know, downstairs is a little, you know...
A little formal for you?
Yeah, a little formal. It's just, you know, it's pretty much unchanged since 1970.
Oh, really?
But, you know, it's exciting. They're about to celebrate their 40th anniversary.
Amazing.
And her goal, I think, is to raise like $20 million for school lunch.
Ah, and that brings us to the second part of the first hour of the main course when we have a taped interview with
part
Bill.
Part one, you mean?
Of part one, yeah.
Not part Q.
Not part Q. We have a taped interview with Bill Telepan of Telepan Restaurants. And Bill, who I've known for quite a while.
He has a restaurant right near your house.
It's pretty near. And I did a little publicity for him back when they opened up. And he's just a terrific guy. And his daughter, Leah, is in the New York City public school system. Mm-hmm. And when he got a load of the lunch situation at his daughter's school, which was also my daughter's school, PS 87 on the Upper West Side, he was appalled. I remember my daughter literally weeping and begging me not to make her eat school lunch. So Bill took a look. At the, if you play that one more time, I'm going to have to kill you. Patrick. Anyway, Bill took a look at the school lunch system, and instead of just throwing up his hands in despair and saying, oh my God, I can't do anything about this, he actually got involved with an organization called Wellness in the Schools, which was you know, developed by two concerned parents. And we should get a couple of these ladies in here because they've really done a lot. And he is in the process now of training school lunch staff and working with the dreadful commodities that the school lunch budget, you know, gives him.
What is it? $3 a meal, right? Or
$2.79? Yeah. It's $2.70, but actually only 93 or 94 cents of that, as you will hear in this interview, goes to the actual food. The rest of it is for, you know, transportation, purchasing, personnel, all of the sort of basic overhead costs.
Now, can't they just do something like a simple, like that egg sandwich you have, just sandwiches and pizzas, but just putting good things on those sandwiches and
the
pizzas?
The problem is that the people who are typically employed in cafeterias and school cafeterias have no training and no food background. They're not cooks. What they are trained to do is open bags, put things on sheet pans, stick them in the oven, or else dunk them in the fryer later. And that's about the extent of cooking in school lunch. And Bill's goal is to develop better you know, better skills for the staff, existing staff, and also to use that 94 cents per kid in a way that makes more sense, where you offer more fresh fruit and vegetables, where you offer, instead of buying chicken nuggets that are breaded and have to be fried, you buy a whole chicken breast or you buy a whole, you know, chicken leg and you shred that up and it can be used as chili, as burritos, as, you know, things that kids are going to respond to better.
You know, actually, one of the things that I saw during this conference of new ideas and new businesses looking for fundraising capital was something called Fruzer, which sounds bad, but they basically freeze immediately all the leftover fruit. Because, you know, when you give a kid an apple, he might not eat the whole apple.
Yeah.
But if it's in the form of an ice cream, you know, then they would. And it has no preservatives, nothing. It's just the thing itself. It's like the technology created for
that sounds
stuff.
Great.
Well, maybe we should take
a short
break
and then we'll come back with Dr. Duckworth.
Blue Ocean Institute.
And
you've been so blind.
My favorite song.
Cool. Well, we're back. It's the main course on Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by Fairway Markets. Hooray, hooray. Thank you so much.
What is Fairway's tagline? Jack, do you know?
Like no other market.
How could we forget that? Fairway is like no other market. Anyway, what we have today, I'm one of your hosts, Katie Kiefer, and
I'm Patrick Martins. This is the main course. We're broadcasting from Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street in the Bushwick neighborhood of Brooklyn.
That's right.
And two shipping containers.
Yeah.
Built by myself and a few other people.
So cool. And now we are pleased to welcome onto our program Dr. Alan Duckworth from the Blue Ocean Institute.
Dr. Alan.
Good afternoon.
I'm supposed to call you doctor, right?
Nobody does apart from my mum.
But you are supposed to not make direct eye contact with him. You know, you're supposed to look down a little bit.
Yeah, like a dog. Or maybe a fish. Perhaps a cephalopod.
Well, this is very cool. Where are you calling in from?
Oh, I'm actually live at Long Island. I'm originally from New Zealand, hence the accent, but my wife lives in Long Island, and my wife's from Long Island, so we decided to come back here.
What is the products of the sea inspiring to you in Long Island, or do you is it not as bountiful and diverse as what you're used to in New Zealand?
I guess every country, every region is different. New Zealand does have a great diversity of seafood, and it's reasonably well managed. Around Long Island, there are some seafoods that are very plentiful, like striped bass, which were overfished for many, many years, but through good management, they're now at record numbers. So some parts of Long Island, the fisheries are reasonably healthy, other parts are not so.
Do you have oysters in New Zealand?
Yeah, we do. We actually have native New Zealand oysters, but most people eat a different oyster called the Pacific oyster, which is from the west coast of the United States. It was imported in about 150 years ago, and that's now the main farmed oyster in New Zealand.
Mm. Amazing. Mm. Alan, can you tell us a little bit about what you do with Blue Ocean? And, let's go right into the things that you and I talked about earlier this week.
Yeah, sure. You know, Blue Ocean Institute, it's a marine conservation institute founded in 2003 by two people, Carl Safina and Mercedes Lee. Although it's a young institute, its sort of foundation goes back almost 20 years. It was part of the National Audubon Society, and then it sort of separated in the early 21st century and became its own institute. It has several programs. Two of the major programs are seafood research, where we look at fished and farmed seafood and determine if they've been produced in an environmentally good way or not. I'm involved in that program. And the second program is climate change, looking at the impacts of climate change on our coasts.
Uh-huh. And I've read and heard stories about how the climate change is causing things like mahi-mahi to be found up on the coast of Maine and so forth. So can you give us some examples of how sort of the rise in temperature in the ocean is changing migratory patterns or breeding patterns or if that matters even? I mean, tell us why that's of concern or even something that we should be tracking.
Yeah, one of the problems with climate change is that the oceans are getting warmer. They've got about 1 degree warmer in the last 100 years, which may not sound a lot, but for a lot of animals, that 1 degree is a big thing. And it does mean that species that sort of found in subtropical, tropical regions are moving further north or further south in the southern hemisphere. American lobster, that's found commonly off New York, New England region. And what they found is that as the oceans are getting warmer, American lobsters, because they sort of like more of a colder, cooler water, they're actually moving north, and the southern populations around Long Island Sound are more prone to disease, and they suspect it's because the warmer water is sort of promoting disease in the lobster populations.
It's a soft shell disease, right? Isn't that what it is? It's like soft shell.
I believe it is. Yeah, but it's problematic throughout the entire world. It's sort of the spread of invasive species. These are species that are not naturally found in a particular region, but as the oceans get warmer, or actually a very common way of the spread of invasive species is through ship ballast. When ships move from country to country, they fill up their tanks with seawater to keep them heavy and stable in the water. And when they get to a new country, they release all that seawater, and that carries juvenile or young new species.
Who knew? Now, that's news to me. I've never heard that before. How interesting.
Now,
that
makes sense. One of the things...
It's a problem in all countries, and invasive species, I mean, a lot of invasive species have no impact at all or simply can't survive in the new habitat and die. But some invasive species, like zebra mussels in the Great Lakes, can be very devastating.
I've been accused of being an invasive species.
But well, I guess in some ways I'm an invasive species as well.
Well, we're happy you're invading Heritage
Radio
today.
That's right, because you're a foreigner.
Now, warning, most people are like, I read in your summary of what you do, like most groups are kind of like dire and, you know, talking about, you know, consequences and very negative, whereas, and Carlo Petrini, who founded Slow Food, always used to say, the world has suffered enough. People suffered enough. We need more positive, influence out there to induce change. And now you guys try to stay very positive through science, art, and literature. That's fascinating. Tell us what some of those projects are.
Yeah, one of the philosophies of Blue Ocean is to inspire hope in current and future generations. Certainly there is a lot of doom and gloom out there, but you know, there's a lot of positive things that are happening as well. And you know, we like to portray or tell those stories as well. Carlos Safino, who's one of the founders of Blue Ocean Institute, spends much of his time writing books that carry a hopeful message, you know, describing some of the problems that we have, but also providing some of the solutions that... that may counteract those. So we talk with other artists. We used to have some resident artists that used to live and work with Blue Ocean Institute, painting and making poems and things like that.
And those things go out to like school children. And I mean, one of the things that always I think is always really key to you know, making change is to indoctrinate children at an early age to respect and love, you know, our planet. And I would imagine that some of those projects were geared towards the educational community.
Yes, certainly. We work closely with Atlantis Aquarium, and we go. They have Atlantis Aquarium is based out of Riverhead on the eastern shores of Long Island, and they take out river tours to educate the public and school groups about what is living in and amongst the coastlines. So we work closely with that. And certainly, you've got to educate the younger generation about the problems that we all encounter.
And the problems with maintaining the status quo, that we can't just keep doing what we're doing, that some things have to change. And I think that let's steer the conversation back to sort of the food chain, and I know that you're an expert on aquaculture and you know, farming seafood and so forth, and that's a subject that I always think is really interesting, because when I learned at a panel recently that the statistics of how much of the food of the fish that we eat is raised in farms, it's 50%, which is way up from even a decade ago or so, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And in fact, this year is an amazing year, because 50% of the seafood that we eat is now farm-raised. For centuries, most of the food that we ate was wild-caught.
Wow. Yeah.
But now today, most of it is, or half of it is farm-raised, and the majority of that is actually from Asia, in particular China. China produces about a third of the world's seafood. Most of which is through farmed.
Is that cause for concern for consumers, given the dismal record of public safety that the Chinese have demonstrated over the last couple of years? Or should we feel relatively confident about Chinese farmed seafood?
Well, I think for the United States and for the American, I think it's always better to farm or to source food locally. Certainly China may have some dodgy practices, but then again, many countries, you know, have dodgy practices. Mm-hmm. But overall, farmed seafood that's farmed within the United States is far better than most farmed seafood farmed elsewhere.
And with country of origin labeling now being mandated in grocery stores, people can be pretty, if you're paying attention and you look at the labels, you can see exactly where seafood is coming from. It's interesting that they don't have that for the other proteins. I don't know why that is.
It's interesting because I've lived in New York now for 2 years, but I've lived in Australia and New Zealand, and both countries, whenever you buy something, there's a country of origin sticker on it. Mm-hmm. So I guess the United States will move towards that way. One of the good things about the United States when it comes to seafood farming is that there's a very strict regulation and monitoring. So that's why
who's
much of the...
Who's in charge of that? Who does that?
The FDA?
I think it is the FDA.
Was it?
And also state regulations. Each state has their own regulations when it comes to farming in state waters or on land.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to ask you something about the history in the Great Barrier Reef, but before we get there, since just to follow this line of thought, the biggest impacts on our oceans and fisheries is the first thing you write, overfishing, bycatch, and habitat destruction. Could you just give us like a headline or two on each of those?
Sure. Overfishing is simply catching fish faster than they can grow and reproduce, and for thousands of years, overfishing wasn't particularly a large problem because we used very small fishing boats. But as fishing boats became, well, as the invention of steam and you know, gas engines, it meant that we could go further, we could tow larger nets. And really, it sort of started, industrialized fishing sort of started in about 1750. Yeah. And since then, some populations have just been overfished. I mean, some of the classics are Atlantic cod.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Mark Kurlansky's book about cod was just fascinating on that subject. And as a corollary to what you're talking about, industrialized fishing, I know that you'll be able to comment about fishing gear. I mean, there's a lot has been written about sort of the type of products that big boats use to drag the bottom of the ocean or these nets that go on for miles and miles. Can you talk about the impact of that kind of fishing on sort of overall populations?
Is that bycatch?
Well, bycatch is part of that.
Yeah, but there's many different ways of catching fish. Some are actually reasonably good, like pole and troll cord tuna. That's simply where a boat is steaming along, and there's lines with either small bits of bait or a lure attached to the line, and it's dragged through the ocean. Tuna come up, or mackerel, or dolphin, mahi mahi, and now they catch them very cleanly. There's very little bycatch because they're very targeted towards a particular seafood, and it causes no habitat destruction. Some fishing methods where a net is, say, dragged along the bottom, which is commonly used to catch, say, haddock, or shrimp, it's incredibly destructive because whatever is in front of that net basically gets destroyed as a net passes over it. And you can destroy nursery habitat, you can resuspend sediments into the water, you can turn over things and break things. Shrimp trawling is in fact one of the worst methods for bycatch. It's estimated that for every 1 pound of shrimp that is caught, 3 to 15 pounds of bycatch is also caught.
Oh,
and that bycatch is just tossed right back into the ocean, typically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, bycatch is simply catching fish that you don't intend to catch. Now, some bycatch is potentially worth some money, so you can sell that. But about two-thirds of the bycatch has no market value, or you're not allowed to keep it because it's undersized or it's above quota.
And you have to those animals are dead by the time they get hauled up.
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah. So much of the bycatch that is caught, and we're talking huge numbers here, potentially 20 million tons of seafood is caught as bycatch each year, and that's just thrown back into the water, normally dead, and it's just a waste. I mean, it's a waste.
Yeah. That's 20 million pounds, folks.
20 million tons.
Tons. Oh, my God. So that's really an astonishing number. I mean, I find that absolutely extraordinary.
And it's a waste because a lot of those fish are juvenile fish. You're destroying ecosystems. I mean, a lot of those fish are considered predators or prey. And also, a lot of the endangered species in our oceans, like seabirds and sea turtles and marine mammals, are also caught as bycatch.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some ways that people are improving or reducing the level of bycatch. Like shrimp trawlers in the United States have to have what's called a turtle exclusion device, which is essentially a large metal grate in front of the bottom of the net. So when a large object, such as a turtle or a large fish, hits this metal grate, it's pushed upwards and out of the net. Uh-huh. So there are often very simple things that fishermen can do to reduce the level of bycatch.
And why aren't they? I mean, who enforces that? Yeah, Patrick and I had the same thought there. How do you make that happen?
It's done by state and federal regulators. But unfortunately, much of the shrimp that Americans eat is caught or farmed overseas, and some of those countries don't enforce that fishermen have to use turtle excluder devices.
Is there a global sort of organization that promotes environmentally sensitive practices such as Blue Ocean? I mean, is there sort of a global, you know, multi-country participant organization that can help to enforce some of these rules?
There's something called the Marine Stewardship Council, which is based in the United Kingdom, but it has branches throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And basically what that does is it certifies fisheries that are fished in a responsible way. It's a very labor-intensive, quite an expensive method, but basically say if a fishery in the United States wants to be certified by the Marine Stewardship Council, they'd go to them, MSC, Marine Stewardship Council, would check out their practices and determine if they have passed a certain level of environmental responsibility. And what that means, if they have, is that on all their seafood, they can put the MSC logo. And at the moment, about a fifth of the world's seafood that's eaten has an MSC logo on it. So
that's what I like about them. They seem very aggressive. Like, you know, a lot of these certification groups are content because they've certified one farm or one group of farms. And MCS, they're constantly coming out with a press release. We brought on 9 new groups or 9 new areas. It's very good.
Remember Tim Fitzgerald who came? We had Tim Fitzgerald from the Environmental Defense Fund on a couple of weeks ago to talk about a lot of these same issues. And he brought up the Marine Stewardship Council. And I think that people should really be educated to look for that label and really take that seriously. Let me ask you, what's the carrot that companies have to encourage them to become certified by the Marine Stewardship Council?
Sorry, I didn't hear your question.
What's their incentive?
I think the majority of people are realizing that their oceans are in trouble, and so that they try and support or buy seafood that's been fished or farmed in a responsible way. And I think that's the carrot with the MSC, is that there's a higher price on seafoods that do carry the MSC logo. In the United States, you don't see as much MSC seafood as you do, say, in Europe or in Australia or New Zealand.
Yeah, I was going to say, because it's not a label that I have particularly noticed when I look. I mean, now we have the country of origin labeling, and
we have so many labels, it can be a detriment. I mean, I don't know why there's not a government-sponsored label that, I mean, you know, that says we sponsor this one, and there's like a big G on it or something like that. You know,
I guess you'd have to talk to a government official. Although the government, the United States government, does have NOAA and NIMS, National Marine Fisheries.
We're going to have somebody from NOAA on in a few weeks. We're going to have somebody from Sea Grant, New York Sea Grant, in a week or two.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left or 7 minutes left. I wanted to ask a few questions about his history and his other work, but did you want to ask a couple more questions about this?
No, go ahead.
Well,
I'll probably interrupt you.
Tell us, I mean, since we have you, and you know, we don't have the plan to cover this anytime soon, but the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute based in Florida, what work are they doing, and what was your job with them with drug compounds and sponges?
I spent almost 4 years working at Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute, which is based in South Florida, and they are a fantastic place to work because they have great experimental toys. They have huge research vessels and submersibles that can go down to 3,000 feet. So we'd go on research cruises, we'd collect marine organisms. And now one of the amazing things about some sponges, some algae, some ascidians, and some these are animals that sort of live on the bottom and don't have really many defenses. So what they produce instead is what's called biological active metabolites, or chemicals that they use to stop things eating them or to fight their own diseases. Mm-hmm. Just by chance, some of those biologically active metabolites we can turn around into drugs, say to fight our cancers. So what my job was to find some of these very interesting compounds and then work out how to commercially farm it in tanks on land. Harbor Branch is a fascinating and amazing place to do research.
Well, and then another question. the Great Barrier Reef. I think everyone, that's like a household name around the world, but what is it, why is it unique, and why is it important?
It's an amazing place. I lived for 3 years in Australia, right by the Great Barrier Reef. It covers basically about a third of the eastern coastline of Australia, and Australia is a huge country like the United States.
How many miles
is
that?
It's a continent.
Yeah, it's a continent. How many miles is that, Alan?
I think it's, I don't know the exact number of miles. Now, the Great Barrier Reef is not one continuous reef. It's about 3,000 little reefs, but all joined together.
Uh-huh.
And it's just an incredible place. And it's basically got three shelves. And when they say shelves, it's sort of like you'd see on a step, on a stairwell.
Uh-huh.
You'd have the inner shelf, the middle shelf, and the outer shelf. And the outer shelf, you're talking about 300-foot visibility, tons of marine life. It's just an incredible place to dive and research. Now, the Australian government realises that the Great Barrier Reef is a major asset for tourism, for fisheries, and for everything. So they've protected it in various ways. And some parts of the reef, you can fish, you can farm seafood there. Other parts, you can only fish there if you're a recreational fisherman. Other parts, you can't even go to. So they've sort of zoned the Great Barrier Reef into various areas that, you know, allow certain types of fishing, farming, or nothing.
Now, what is a reef exactly? Is it just a place that has, I mean, what, I know.
On the Great Barrier Reef, it's composed of coral reefs. So a coral, over time, it settles, say, on a piece of rock or shell. It grows larger, and then over millennia, new coral forms on top. And over time, you get this extensive coral reef, which can descend down to, say, 200-300 feet, although most of the coral live at the top 100 feet. Coral, it is an animal, but it lives in close harmony with a symbiotic algae, which lives inside their tissues. And it's the algae that, when exposed to sunlight, gives the energy to the coral. So although it's an animal, it actually relies on photosynthesis to obtain its energy. And that's why you find it in warm tropical water that's clear.
Yeah.
And tell us about swimming with saltwater crocodiles. Are they the biggest crocodiles?
I mean,
like, did you ever encounter one? What are they like? Tell us about that animal.
When I worked in Australia, there's a lot of in Australia. There's 24 million people that live there, of which there's about 500,000 that are Indigenous Australians, and much of them live along the coast, and they live in very small, remote communities, and they don't have lot of industry, high unemployment, and so what I was paid to do was to go into these communities and set up bath sponge farms. And now a bath sponge is a sponge that is from the wild, but you can clean it easily, and then you can sell it as a bath sponge.
And you all bought them at Duane Reade, absolutely.
Yeah, and so that was my job, was to find bath sponges and then work with the locals, either Aboriginal Australians or Torres Strait Islanders, and set up bath sponge farms for them. Some of the areas that I worked in, the water was infested with saltwater crocodiles. And these crocodiles can get over 20 feet in length. The largest I saw was about 16 feet.
Wow.
But it was just insane because...
That's longer than this studio.
Are they... Are they longer than, like, freshwater crocodiles?
Yes. Yeah, the saltwater crocodile is the largest crocodile in the world, and it's the most dangerous crocodile in the world.
And do they swim with regular people kind of thing, like in these reefs? I mean, could...
No. If you see a saltwater crocodile, you get out of the water as quickly as possible. You very rarely see saltwater crocodiles because they're normally found in sort of muddy, estuarine waters. Mm. Although they're called salt water, they're really not pure salt water.
It's like marshy, estuary-type water?
So you don't, occasionally they swim out to the reef, but generally they're found close to the coast.
Mm.
But you'll be diving. I mean, I used to dive in waters that were 10 feet in visibility. So you could, if you were plonked down on the bottom, you could see 10 feet in front of you.
That's not very far.
You knew that somewhere in the water, whether it was 20 feet away or 200 feet away or 2 miles, there was crocodiles that were 15 feet in length.
Sure, and they can smell you.
Oh, really?
They can sense you, yes. And it was just incredible. I mean, it was incredibly stupid and dangerous, but it was an amazing dive. And it was incredible to live and work with Indigenous Australians. I mean, although Australia is a first world country and it has a lot going for it, a lot of these remote communities were dirt poor. The average life expectancy is 42.
No way.
Yeah, and they just don't have much going for them. So that's why.
So the that's the Aboriginal community, and what other? What was you mentioned the other name of a like sort of a tribal sounding name? What was that?
Torres Strait Islanders. Torres Strait is located between Great Barrier, the top of Queensland, Australia, and Papua New Guinea. It's a set of islands.
Oh.
And it was formed after the last glaciers melted, so at about 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. Torres Strait Islanders are Melanesian. Australian Aborigines have been living there for at least 50,000 years.
Wow.
Very distinct people, different cultures, just incredibly friendly, incredibly amazing, and very non-Western.
Very non-Western, yeah. And hence the lack of industry as we know it in the Western world.
Yeah, they live off the land. I mean, they go out and actively hunt for turtles, for dugongs, similar to the manatee. They talking about saltwater crocodiles, I lived and worked on an island that had 200 people living there.
Wow.
And after school, the little kiddies would go down to the water's edge and play in the water, as all kids do on the coast. And around this island, they had three crocodiles that were over 15 feet. They had hundreds of crocodiles, but three large man-killers.
Wow.
And crocodiles are creatures of habit. They're very lazy. And they realized that after a while, one of the crocodiles started to lie in wait for the kiddies to come down after school, and they just had to kill it to remove it.
Damn right.
One of the other crocodiles ate somebody 10 years ago, so now possessed the soul of that person. They weren't allowed to kill that one croc, but the croc that did, that started to wait for the kiddies after school, they had to kill it with a gun.
So if it had eaten a kid, they wouldn't have been able to kill it. That's weird. But what fish or what animal of the sea kills the most humans every year? Do you know the answer to that?
No, I don't actually.
I mean, it's not sharks, right?
No, sharks only kill about 4 people a year, and in return we kill about 10 million of them.
Yeah.
Jellyfish kill a few people a year.
And then what's that animal, the stingray killed the famous Australian...
Steve Irwin, yeah. And that was very unfortunate. He got stung right through the heart.
Which is the only place that would have killed him, right?
Yeah. You know, probably the biggest killer of people in the water is ourselves. I mean, I'm sure we do so many stupid things in the water that we drown or we go out in unseaworthy boats. But I don't know what animal kills more humans than anything else.
Did you ever encounter oar fish?
No, they're normally deep water. So you'd only see an oar fish close to the surface, probably at night time if it was sick.
Patrick is obsessed with oar
fish. No, but it's so funny because we have a picture of an oar fish as a screensaver on our computer and no one believes it to be real.
I have seen giant squid, though.
Oh, really?
When I was in New Zealand, the fishermen used to catch accidentally as bycatch giant squid, and they used to give them to the research institute I worked at, and we saw giant, these were all dead, but they were, some of them were almost 40 feet in length. The eye alone was the size of a dinner plate. It was incredible.
Oh,
they can pull a small boat down, right?
Yeah, but they don't.
No, I think that's Hollywood legends, although there are some squid called the Humboldt squid off California in Mexico, that's actually moving north because the water's getting warmer, but mm-hmm. they are potential man killers. They only get to about 8 feet, but they're very inquisitive and very powerful. And there has been reports where fishermen from Mexico have been fishing at night, catching a Humboldt squid and basically being attacked by the squid and being pulled back into the water and then eaten.
Incredible.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they got a right. Cephalopods have a very evolved... consciousness.
Really?
Yeah, they do.
And so, did you say earlier on that people eat dolphin? Is that true?
Dolphin fish is mahi-mahi.
Oh, I see. Because no one eats dolphin, right? Why? Is
they're
it because the meat
to.
Is unedible or because no, they're intelligent?
Some cultures still eat marine mammals. Even you know, the Inuits in the United States are allowed to catch one or two bowhead whales a year. Mm. Some cultures overseas eat whales and dolphins. The problem with, apart from the conservation side, a lot of the animals, a lot of the large animals, such as a dolphin or a whale, has lived for a long, long time, and over time they bioaccumulate toxins. And if you eat their meat, you're basically ingesting a lot of dangerous toxins. And that's one of the concerns with some of the seafood that we eat today. It's loaded up with mercury or polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs.
Right. Well, isn't that the problem with, like, orange roughy, which I know is on the endangered species list, but we learned recently that they can live to be 120 or 130 years old, so I imagine you can put away a lot of toxins in that period of time.
They can, but even short-lived species, like one of the concerns with the farmed salmon that we eat, it does cause a lot of environmental pollution, but it also often contains high levels of PCBs.
Mm-hmm. Why is that, if they're farmed?
It's because they're often farmed in areas where there was a lot of industrial runoff, and PCBs were used extensively to insulate, and they had many, many different uses, but they'd often leach out and go into the waterways, into the rivers, and then into the coasts. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, some of those areas is where our farmed salmon comes from.
I have one last question, and then I think we have to wrap this up, Alan. You've been so nice, and I hope you'll come back. Excuse me. Talking about runoff, you know, one of the biggest arguments against industrialized farming is the effect on the water table of fertilizer and pesticides. And so are you seeing in your work in the oceans, are you seeing a ratcheting up of the levels of toxins that are associated with agricultural waste?
Yes, and unfortunately it happens throughout the world. I mean, you may have heard of dead zones, which are areas that next to the sort of the mouths of rivers where essentially there's so much nutrients, it fuels a massive algae bloom, but the algae over, you know, in a couple of days or weeks die. And when they die, as they decompose, they suck all the oxygen out of the water, which creates a huge dead zone, and nothing can really survive in that water. And that's 30 years ago, there's like 3 dead zones in the entire world, and now there's about 500, and that number's grown exponentially each year. And when there's not a dead zone, it's a concern.
And that is really due to industrial agricultural practices.
Yeah, it's mostly due to nutrient and fertilizer runoff from farmland that makes its way into the waterways. The Chesapeake Bay is a massive watershed catchment area. And one of the reasons why the Chesapeake Bay is in poor condition is because all these nutrients are fueling algae blooms, which upset the ecosystem. And when they die, basically anything that lives close to the bottom, such as blue crabs or oysters, gets suffocated or live in an area where there's not enough oxygen for them to survive.
Amazing. Very cool. Let's wrap this up. Dr. Alan Duckworth. Oh, we're going to do a drop, and then I'm going to come back and reference people
this
to you.
This is in honor of the fish theme.
Okay. Hi, this is Moby, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Dr. Alan Duckworth from the Blue Ocean Institute, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, you were great.
Terrific. Please come back. I want to keep up the dialogue about the seafood industry and our waterways. I think that's just as important as focusing on all the other sustainable practices that we need to change in this country and around the world.
And please come back live here at Roberta's.
Yeah, we'd love to have you come to the studio sometime. Bring the wife and kitties.
Sounds very good.
It would be a pleasure to have you here. And so again, this has been The Main Course. This is Dr. Alan Duckworth from Blue Ocean Institute.
And we're coming
back. Check out their website. We'll be back with an interview from...
What is their website?
It's www.blueocean.org.
Very, very
cool. Or Blue Ocean Institute? Blueocean.org.
We're going to find out before
BlueOcean.org, you're right.
BlueOcean.org, I thought so, because I've Googled it a million times now.
English people always sound very, very, very intelligent.
He's from New Zealand.
No, I know. And then New Zealand people all sound very, very, very nice. You know, there's just something like, if someone's from New Zealand or Australia, you're naturally like want to like hang out with them and have a beer.
Absolutely.
English people you want to like learn from like at a university. All right, guys. Jesus. Well, we're going to be back with, we're going to go straight to a piece
to Telepan.
Do you do an intro for it and everything?
I can do an intro, yeah.
Okay.
Without you, I'll be doing time. Without you, I'll be doing all right. Get your way at the stage you play.
Called Wellness in the Schools, trying to revamp school cafeteria menus. What? How did you get into that? Let's start with the basics.
Well, basically, a couple of the moms that are at my school started Wellness in the Schools, and one day they were showing off some of their wraps that they made put together to put on the school menu as far as cold food goes, and then I just asked them what I can do to help with the hot food. And then here we are.
Wow. And I understand from reading the article in Edible Magazine in the September issue, it's obvious that you're spending a lot of time devoting yourself to both preparing the school meals, but also training the staff.
Yeah, what we did was last year we started off in my daughter's school by putting together a salad bar, worked into sandwiches, and then actually cooked a meal in the school. And we decided to replicate that into a couple other schools. So we got some volunteers through the French Culinary Institute. And then going into this year, more schools reached out to WITS, or Wellness in the Schools. And so now we're up to 8 schools that we're working with.
Fantastic. I had no idea. What kind of products do they give you to work with? I mean, how hard is it for you to change what the status quo is, and how hard is it to... introduce new ingredients?
Well, we're trying to introduce new ingredients, but I'm actually using the products that they use. So what basically the idea was that they're basically opening boxes of frozen food and then popping them into the oven and then serving them. So we, as far as the hot food goes, we want them to cook more. And they could cook more with what they have, whether it's frozen or canned vegetables, and just sort of do a and make them healthier. They're a lot healthier when there's a lot fewer ingredients in than, say, a bag of chili that they get. And certainly we're trying to do more plant-based items because the meat the protein and the meats they're getting in are sort of subsidized government-issued meat that is tampered. I call it tampered with, but overly processed.
Well, it's the commodity beef.
It is the commodity beef that has...
And it's the kind of beef patties that have been the subject of a lot of recalls.
Yes, and they also have... There's proteins in it. They put a lot of sodium in there. So there's a high... So it's just not very good, and there's too many ingredients in them. So I went in the direction, as far as hot food goes, to sort of take the recipes they use and actually develop them into a way to make them healthier and with less sort of processed food in them, and then just training the staff because they don't cook a lot anymore. And we also, in our schools, and you know, we're hoping to get more salad bars. So we've in all the schools we're working with, there will be a full salad bar by mid-October in all the new schools. Already in the 3 schools we started working with last year, we're going to start next week with them.
Does the school Department of Education provide you with the materials for the salad bar? How have you managed to get that going? Because that seems like a fairly radical new addition to the school menu.
Well, it's not. According to their recipe booklet, it's not. It's just a matter of them having to do it. You don't actually need the cold salad bar. There's ways to sort of lay out the salad on ice packs and hotel pans that will keep the salad at a temperature that's safe. And then you can also... but, you know, they are supposed to be able to provide a salad bar. I mean, that's what they're supposed to
that's
do.
That's been mandated in the
regulations. Yeah, and it's just a matter of them sort of, it's a cost-cutting measure by them for not using them.
Mm-hmm. And what's the biggest challenge? Is it the getting better ingredients, or is it training the staff?
I mean, well, right now, I mean, as far as getting better ingredients, it's kind of like close to impossible because of the contracts they have. We're working on towards a doing a farm-to-school program, which is going to be a tough nut to crack. We're just trying to get them to get in for their vegetables, the hot vegetables that they serve. We're trying to get in fresh vegetables as opposed to frozen or canned. And the training of the staff, you know, some of them, you know, we've sort of, it's been split. We've had some who just want to open the box and do as little as possible. And then we have some that really actually care and are interested in doing a better thing. So. Mm-hmm.
And what is the average expenditure of a school lunch?
Well,
I mean, what is it?
It's when you break down
pennies a day.
It's 94
right?
cents a day, 94 wow. cents to a dollar. But there is some extra money in there. There is a little wiggle room for it. But it's basically the government gives you 94 cents.
So if you could demonstrate to the powers that be, who are the what do you say? I guess the sort of commissary that supplies these, or the contracts that you have with various suppliers, if you could somehow demonstrate that providing better ingredients at the same cost was better for the school system overall, do you think that you could eventually wean the system off of those contracts, or do you think that's a system that is so entrenched?
Well, it's harder than that. I think the first thing is that you need more money per child. You know, if mm-hmm. if we had $1.94 to work with, given that they buy for a million kids, you have a lot of power in there. And I think that one of the things they need to do with the specs, we're really working on this and been talking to them about this, and it's probably our highest priority is on the specs for the chicken and the beef, is to why instead of taking a chicken, pulling it off the bone, grinding it up, mixing in fat, sodium, and other, you know, bad things, and then breading it, why can't we just get a piece of chicken that you pull off the bone and then cook and maybe season with a little salt and pepper, freeze, and then they could open that up, and that's a lot better. And then it's also something you work with better. You can cut up that chicken breast and put it into wraps. You could cut the thigh meat up and put it into pasta sauces and chilies and things like that. As far as the beef's concerned, they're saying that they need to add all this stuff because they have a basic dry hamburger. Well, or, you know, but... I don't buy that. I think that if they do take them and then leave them in the oven, there's also a way to cook them. You know, I've seen things where they put ravioli into the steamer and let it sit there for an hour for the entire service. And so, of course, the ravioli, whether it's really bad, is going to be worse. And then as far as their green beans, they're leaving them in for like an entire service. So those are things that can be done where, like, you know, I believe that if you take a hamburger that's already pre-cooked, and then pop it in the oven to warm, and then properly cook it, you know, it'll be fine, and it's got to be a lot better than what they have.
How open are the children to trying new things?
The kids, one of the things we did at PS 87 is we did a salad bar day to introduce the whole thing, and the kids went nuts. We had them. We doubled basically the service that day from 350 to 700, and I had kids coming up to me all the weeks after saying how much they loved it. I had parents coming up to me saying, "Oh, their kid never tried corn before, but they love the salad. Can I have the recipe?" The next day, we did a sandwich. We did two wraps. We did a mozzarella tomato wrap, and we did a chicken Caesar wrap. And you know, the kids, they went nuts. I mean, they really are willing to try new things. And I have a daughter, and she'll try things, you know what I mean? And some are reluctant, and some will be more adventurous. But I think overall it was, you know, the kids have something that tastes a little better, that's better for them, and they just feel better. The most important thing is they feel so much better going into that second half of the day, and then they're not sleepy, and
their attention span.
I mean, there have been studies that show that their attention spans are better, and they do better in school if they eat healthier. And for a lot of these kids, a lot of New York City children, this is the only meal of the day that they're going to have that is anything sufficient and can be healthy. It's the only shot that they have, and we should have an obligation to supply that to them.
I think so. Yeah. Let me ask you this. What about things like using a lot of ethnic cuisines? Because so many of the kids come from like a Latin background. Beans and rice, it seems to me, are two of the cheapest things on the planet.
They are.
Produce.
They are.
And most kids will eat them.
Yes, of course they do.
But I never see that on a menu.
The thing is, you know, the school heads of school food will set up a menu, and you can have there. You are able to swap out dishes, and so one of the things we're going to be doing in our 8 schools. Is twice a month. Well, you know, I developed this vegetarian chili recipe that we're going to serve twice a month at our schools. And we are able to do that. And we're going to also try to have the workers in there. We'll get to talk to them and talk to them what the kids really like. So we may have like rice and bean day with roasted chicken and let them do that. We've been successful in one of the schools we're working in. We're trying to get that into all the other schools. And this way we could swap out breaded chicken patty day on a bun for like, you know, rice and chicken arroz con pollo day or something like that.
Absolutely.
And then have...
And you would save money.
Yes.
I mean, ultimately that would be cheaper, right?
And they also have, you know, so we will work with the schools and they do too. But it's a matter of, it's such a big system that they need to sort of... and since you have to feed so many kids in the safety zone, you know,
sure.
You can't get the kids sick. You have to make everybody aware of what's going on. So they need a better communication program. We're trying to help them with that. We're trying to help them with their training of the staff. We've come up with a training program for them to use that we're doing in our schools that hopefully they'll, adapt. And this way they can allow, the people can, you know, find better things to cook and more ethnic things to cook.
Right. Have you been following the whole career of Ann Cooper, who was in Long Island and now is at Berkeley and has got it partnered up with Whole Foods? And
you know, I think anything anybody can do to raise this issue, I think what's great is that it's kind of like it is a hot topic and the time is right for all this. So if there's a way we can all work together to get this. I mean, the Children's Nutrition Act is coming up, and we need to get that sort of changed. And this way we can get more money for the – so if anybody's out there listening, call your senator and tell them to vote in favor of it and raising the price. I think that's what it is. I mean, all these people, they've done wonderful jobs. It's all wonderful.
It is. It's all wonderful, and it's long overdue. And one final question is about if you are sort of successful over the long term in raising the quality of the ingredients that you're allowed to bring into schools, say if you, for instance, get a little more funding, how much do you think this will have an impact? What kind of an impact will this have on sort of local agriculture and small farmers? I mean, the idea is to try to float everybody's boat, right?
Right. I think that's the problem. I think there's so much to offer in this area, and there's so much to offer in many areas. And I think we're looking at that very seriously because of many reasons. I think the food is better. You know, it's better. For all those reasons, I buy from farmers. And I think that. And just to support them, and I think it's silly that we are not doing that. They're looking right now to get the scary thing is that they look at each child as a customer and not a child, and that's where it bothers me a lot. When they start calling in some of their materials, they're called customers, and that's the way they treat them, and that's their.
But their customer service leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah, they need to make it's a there's certain money issues that really bother me that they don't even think about. And listen, they might get pressure from it in one way, but then their superiors have to sort of think about it in different ways. But nobody's really thinking about it as, you know, you're feeding a child, you're feeding the future, and you've got to give these kids a chance. And for them to be fed the fast food quality stuff that they're fed,
it's obesity
is, you know, I mean, there's all kind of health issues on it. And
sure.
It's really a problem. That's why I'm doing this, to help change that part, like to raise that concern that like they're looking at them as customers, and sad.
Are there other chefs of your caliber who are participating in this program, or are you kind of?
We are trying to do a chef in residence program, and it's where we could teach, just sort of like like introducing kids to different foods in the classroom, talk to them about cooking, and and those kind of things. So we're looking
for... Like the Days of Taste program?
Kind of like the... Exactly like the Days of Taste program.
Which I did not think that was particularly impressive, but maybe it's...
No, it was actually... It was very impressive.
Did it work well?
Oh, yeah. No, it worked great. And I, you know, the thing about the Days of Taste thing is if you could change one kid... It's like anything. If you could change one kid's life and going into... I would have the kids visit me on their own to say hi to me... because of the program, and it was really a wonderful program. They didn't get their funding this year, unfortunately, to do it, and which was pretty sad. And so this is a similar program where we have all of our volunteers who are working with us are going to volunteer if they want to some time to doing it. We'd like to get more chefs involved, so if anybody, again, listening, they could call and reach out to me, and I could help them get more involved in that. And if there's ways to get more involved. There's a lot of chef parents out there who we'd love to have them help us out in their school. So
absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I just realized I have one more question, and that is a question that always interests me about trying to tie sort of better food quality to institutional food, and that's the distribution system. And it seems to me that the biggest problem that small farmers have in terms of getting connected with, say, a school lunch program would be to find distribution that takes the burden of collection and transportation out of their hands and puts it into another...
Yes, that is a problem. And I think one of the things the green markets in New York City are trying to do is they're actually going to set up, or we actually talked to them about them setting up, and I think they might have done this earlier, they do, in a wholesale stall in the Hunts Point Market where they're able to, you know, sell their products and get to the distributors of the school. And we're trying to make that connection now.
I think that's kind of the key connection, because without connecting the source to the plate, it's going to be a long way before you start getting these guys involved in the program.
We're trying to push them towards that. I mean, that a lot of these things takes months because of you know, resistance or unwillingness. A lot of, you know, just like anything, people don't like change so much, that especially when it makes their life harder. But what they don't understand is that, you know, once they start moving towards a way that's going to be better for everyone, then it'll just get easier. It's just going to get easier. I mean, they made a really complicated system, and it only, right? And the thing is, it had to have taken some work to make it so complicated.
Yeah.
And so there is a way to unravel that and make and change. And it's just a matter of, like, the willingness to do it and then just putting your head down and working towards it. And then one day they're going to wake up and look up and they're going to be like, wow, why didn't we do this sooner?
Right. And hopefully they could be a model for other cities across the United States. And that would be the goal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Child Nutrition Act, if we could change that, I mean, that'll help everybody out. If they could get more money toward it. I mean, I think Alex Waters sort of put some money together. I think they were getting, like, you know, $9 billion. And if she said, if we could get $27 billion, then we would have exactly what we need. And, you know, we may not get triple what we need, but if we could get, you know, half, you know, 50% more than what we have, or even, you know, 100%
more. Well, if you had $1.50 instead of 94 cents per kid, that would make a huge impact.
It's crazy. It would be a huge impact. But, you know, the government has to appease all these people who, you know, they subsidize as far as, you know, meat farms. So they got a little balancing act to do also. And that's what I mean. They could say, well, we can't do it because we have to take care of these people, and that's it. But how can we create these mechanisms in their policies and what they do to sort of make the changes? We're not saying you have to change it tomorrow, but let's look at 3 to 5 to 10 years down the road. 60 years ago, school lunch was locally bought from the area and produced in the schools, you know?
That's right.
And that was only 60 years ago, you know? So we can sort of do something.
We can roll the clock back,
you know,
a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah. So.
Well, Bill, I'm going to wrap it up here, but thanks very much. I hope you'll come on to the show sometime with us and talk more about this. It's been great, and it's good to see you again. And this is Bill Talapan with The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. Great. See you soon.